Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with authors, historians, filmmakers, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Colonel Kevin Benson, who is a retired, decorated U.S. Army veteran of 30 years. He operated in many roles, including colonel, former director of the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, was the director of plans of the 3rd U.S. Army during Operation Iraqi Freedom, has a PhD in American history, which is pretty impressive, and is the author of today's book, Expectation of Valor, Planning for the Iraq War. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Yes. So you are like the guy to talk to about the Iraq War. And I'm sure a lot of people have a lot of
questions.
Can I
quote you on that?
Yeah, go ahead. So, okay, first and foremost, can you give us just a brief description of what the Operation Iraqi Freedom was?
Well, Operation Iraqi Freedom was the Army's campaign, not just the Army, the joint campaign conducted by U.S. Central Command and the Coalition of the Willing to remove Hussein from power and to assist putting in place in Iraq a democratically elected government. And we also, you know, look for an existence of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, did follow through with his destruction of these under UN supervision after the first Gulf War. Did he cache any of them, all of that? But that's essentially what it was.
That's a great description. You're bringing back so many memories for me, all of those words and terms, hearing them on the news all the time. So yeah, we actually went in there to be like, are you stopping the way that you said you were stopping? So we were there before we officially had any sort of combat or anything like that. We were there to just check out if he was following what he said.
That happened in the interim between the first Gulf War and then Iraqi freedom. There were UN supervised missions to oversee the destruction of weapons of mass destruction and the cataloging of chemicals that were precursors to chemical weapons, things like that, detailing where the term yellow cake, where uranium material that could be used to form the type of uranium needed for nuclear weapons and then continue to refine it. But where all of those were, Iraq and all the various sites and ammunition dumps and things like that, there was UN supervision of most. But if you recall the history, Saddam would periodically prevent them from going to sites, would frustrate their attempts, would throw them out of the country, would prevent overflights of U-2 reconnaissance airplanes and other reconnaissance airplanes to monitor any of his activities. All of that went on prior to that, prior to 9/11, and then our actual invasion in 2003.
It seems like, he was walking around kind of threatening nuclear decisions and ambitions and things like that, and kind of being shady about allowing us to check things out a little bit. It seems reasonable to go, not so sure about this guy. And a lot of people are like, he didn't have any weapons, but there's no certainty at the time of anything until you go and look. And he was acting kind of weird when we got there. But you were in the higher ranks of the military during Operation Iraqi Freedom. And
yes,
you were part of the planning that went into what we're doing before, during, and after. Can you tell us about what your position was there?
Yes. Thank you for asking that question. My official title was the Deputy Chief of Staff for Planning, C for Combined, / J for Joint, 5 at the Combined Forces Land Component Command that was built around the headquarters of the organization, the U.S. Army organization I was in, which was 3rd U.S. Army. So I, simply put, I was the director of plans.
That's a pretty big deal. And I have to say, so your book is really awesome. It gives a lot of information. It's not too overwhelming. And that's what I like about, that's what I liked about it. I like to have guests on the show where, you know, you can read the book if you don't know a ton about this already.
So
it's so interesting. There's so much in there about all of the planning that went into this, trying to get everybody to work together. What are we going to do when we leave? But there's still this idea that hangs around that we didn't have all this plans and we didn't do planning, but you were the guy, you were there, you did it. There was so much planning. Why do you think there's this idea that we didn't plan enough?
Well, essentially it's because the outcome and the fact that we were there for so long. And that's part of the motivation of why I wrote the book, because I had heard so many, even U.S. Army generals who really knew better, would contribute to the line that, you know, we didn't think beyond the initial invasion. We didn't have a plan for the initial invasion. Or that the planners were ill-informed. Thus, commanders were put in bad positions where they only had bad choices to make. And things like that. It irritated me, frankly.
I can imagine. But, it's irritating to think about that.
Well, but that's what we did. I was not only my last assignment in the Army was the director in the School of Advanced Military Studies. I was also a student there when I majored. And what our Army does is the school teaches and prepares general staff officers to think of what we, excuse me, the totality of a military campaign, which is the start to the finish. And the finish is when you tie the accomplishment of military objectives to conditions for policymakers to say, we've won. And that's the way I was educated. That's the way we approached the planning for Operation Iraqi. And as we termed it, you know, our name for our operation was COBRA 2.
I was going to ask about that.
And that's because we were 3rd Army, and 3rd Army was commanded famously by General Patton in World War II. The first operation that gave birth to 3rd Army in Europe in 1944 was COBRA. And we thought, well, how about COBRA 2? A little historical touch to to what we do. Yeah, I had a great officer who worked for me. His name is Evan Helfer. And Evan had a PhD in history. He had taught at the Military Academy. And, you know, I just said, Evan, let's find a cool name for the op, because we're the planners. We get to do that. And Evan said, COBRA 2. I was like, yeah, okay. And of course, our command general approved it, but still.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I could get behind that. That is the coolest thing. Oh, man, you got to name it. I mean, that's like naming a star. Like, that is just like once in a lifetime opportunity.
It really was.
Yeah. Wow. And okay. So that's a pretty cool name. And you spent decades studying war, military tactics, policies, all these things, but you also have some boots on the ground experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that field experience before 9/11?
Sure. I was commissioned from the U.S. Military Academy and as a lieutenant. So I went into the armor branch. So I was a tanker and a cavalryman. I served in tank units. I served in cavalry units, armored cavalry, I'm not a very good horse rider.
I did all of the things
that an Army officer does to advance in your career. I led a platoon of soldiers, 45 soldiers. I commanded a tank company, about 100 guys and 17 tanks and other sorts of gear.
Wow.
I was the operations officer of a tank battalion in Europe, 54 M1 A1 tanks. And then I was privileged to command a U.S. Army tank battalion at Fort Texas, 3rd Battalion, 8th Cavalry. And as long with the staff assignments that I had, I was an aide-de-camp to a general when I was a lieutenant. I worked in Washington in the Army's personnel directorate, assigning officers' jobs. But when I went back to the field, I was with field units, as we say. So after I graduated from the School of Advanced Military Studies as a major, I was assigned to the 18th Airborne Corps, which a lot of folks thought that pretty funny because, I'd gone to airborne school and gotten my paper wings when I was a cadet and hadn't jumped out of an airplane since. And now, I'm a mid-30s major, and I'm going to jump out of airplanes again, which...
Was that exciting or
no,
terrifying?
It was terribly exciting. It really was. The story my wife tells about me is all the difference between what had a good landing and a not-so-good landing. Because if I had a not-so-good landing, I needed her heating pad that night when I got home. And if I had a reasonably good landing, I needed the heating pad a day or so later.
Oh, my goodness. That's really funny. Oh, man, lots of experience.
So that's what I did. The Army, insists on, it's a profession, the profession of arms. And you take that seriously. So I read books on my own. I went to the Army school. I got a chance to go to a school with the Marines. I tried to write articles and think about the conduct of warfare.
You were actually, you really earned your place at the top of the, in the higher ranks there. You knew what you were doing. It wasn't like, just somebody that was put there.
I'd like to think so, yes.
I would say so. That one vote from me.
Well, thanks. So see, the other thing, if I may, just is with all of that, I didn't go to war until I was a colonel. There was the Urgent Fury in Grenada. I was a company commander at the time, missed that. The invasion of Panama, I didn't go to that. The first Gulf War, I was at Fort Leavenworth going to the staff college, missed that one. So I never was in any of the fights that the Army was in my career. I was a colonel near the end of my career. But again, that's, you join the Army and you accept that you're in the profession of arms. And so your moral obligation is to be prepared to go to war whenever the nation requires it of you. And to be the best prepared you can be in the place where you're serving. And I was the lead planner. My obligation was to put together the best possible plans.
I love the way that you lay all of those things out. You take us through this story of, how it starts and kind of the problems and issues of getting everybody together and how it all kind of comes together in the end. And definitely a lot more than I was aware of that went into the planning. This book is very enlightening. And
thank you.
I highly recommend it to anybody interested in the Iraq War or war in Iraq. Can you just tell us a brief description of what Central Command is? That's important.
Sure. United States Central Command is one of the regional combatant commands that the way our Department of Defense has apportioned headquarters to look at specific regions on the planet. And U.S. Central Command was charged with the conduct of all U.S. military activity in the central region bound with Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, Iran, Pakistan, Egypt, around the Red Sea. But that's the regional focus of U.S. Central Command.
Okay. So, and you guys were responsible, again, for not just planning the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but also combat during the war and what was going to happen afterwards.
Yes.
I wanted to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Pardon me.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, just the rest of it is Central Command also has subordinate headquarters below it. So 3rd U.S. Army, which is the Army component, is a Marine component, a Navy component, and an Air Force component, all of which were 3-star general or vice admiral level commands that would exercise the command and control of all the forces that were apportioned, sent to the region for everything from the routine naval patrols, maritime interdiction operations that would go on enforcing the UN sanctions on Iraq, the Air Force flying operations Northern Watch and Southern Watch that put the air forces for the region monitoring Saddam's operations and ensuring that he wasn't flying below or above the lines in the air, if you will. So all of those were part of the day-to-day activities. And for us in Third Army, there were exercises that were conducted. An annual exercise with the Egyptians. There was almost continuous exercises with the Kuwaitis that was a deterrent effect on Saddam.
Yeah.
Don't invade because there's Americans there.
Yeah.
And so those were the, if you will, sort of the routine, and not routine at all, but the day-to-day activities that Central Command oversaw. I hope
that
clarifies.
It does. It's very cohesive, but departmentalized kind of operation, making sure that everything is being watched.
Sure.
Can I ask, so there's this idea of before the world before 9/11, at least in our government, right? And then after 9/11.
Sure.
When you were there planning and these daily operations, was it fundamentally different from you expect from what you expected because you were in a post 9/11 world? Was it kind of just, did things change up a lot internally because of that?
Oh, yes, very much so. This was my second assignment at Third Army. So I'd been there once before. And, during peacetime, if you will, pre 9/11. So in that time, we were in the maintenance of our major operations plan. So we were established, we were continually refining them. And then those were in a, if you will, a routine peacetime process of a sequence of briefings to Central Command and to our Army staff, into the Joint Staff and the Pentagon. But there was time, if you will, to be able to get details correct and go back and forth and argue points.
Okay.
What changed afterwards when I joined the headquarters in July of 2002 was the pressure of the headquarters had already gone to war in terms of Afghanistan. And while it wasn't officially declared we're going to go and invade Iraq, inside the headquarters, we knew that's what was next. And so there is the pressure of, we know we're going to execute this operation.
Right.
We damn well better get it right. And, even though plans are just plan, and we say the enemy gets a vote. And once the invasion begins, well, then, you know, the plan only gets you to what we say the line of departure, the where the forces start the fight. And then after that, the plan helped, but it was more the thinking and the planning that went into it, because everyone has to adapt after that. And so that's what when I say we have to get it right. We had to get the sequencing of the arrival of our forces, and not just the tanks and the infantry and in field artillery, the engineers, the bridges, the truck companies, the petroleum moving companies, the ammunition handlers, the air defense for missiles and aircraft, the helicopter units, the totality of the force, and getting it into place in Kuwait, coming from the United States, coming from Europe, factoring in how long does it take a ship to go from the port of Beaumont, Texas, through the Gulf of America, across the Atlantic, through the Mediterranean, Suez Canal, Bab al-Mandeb, Straits of Hormuz. You have to factor all of that in. And then once the unit gets to Kuwait and the port, how long does it take to offload the ships? How long does it take the soldiers flying in? You see what I'm saying? All of those details became a part of the planning effort. And it's just to get us in place to start the fight.
Oy. That's enormous. That's huge. All of that planning. Yeah. So the famous phrase that the best laid battle plans don't survive the first shot. And it sounds that would apply to the planning phase, too. It's not just battle plans. The best laid invasion plans don't survive the first landing or something.
And actually, as we caveated it, don't survive first contact with the Secretary of Defense.
Really? Can you give us any stories of that stick out to you?
Of course. Well.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear it.
The planning and the planning process that we teach in our schools includes, I have a chapter in the book called TIPFL, Time, Phase, Force, Deployment, List. That's the work that goes on that essentially links the movement of soldiers from Riley, Kansas, and puts their equipment on trains and some of it on truck convoys, and moves those trains down to the port of Beaumont, Texas, in time for a ship from the Ready Reserve Fleet, the cargo ships, to arrive, load ships, and some soldiers get on the ships to go with the equipment, while others remain at Fort Riley, and then are linked up with airplanes to fly to the Persian Gulf in time for them to acclimate and be on the ground in time so that when the ships arrive, and all of that detailed work is the establishment of the time-phased force deployment list. So we did all of that kind of work. And then in January of 2003, Secretary Rumsfeld, and, well within his rights, told us that the president has not yet taken a decision to go to war. And the secretary equated his approval of to beginning the force flow as ahead of the president's decision to take a declaration of war. So he said, we are not going to execute the time phase force deployment list.
Sure.
And he said, you will go back and break it all down and put in requests for forces so that the 3rd Infantry Division was then being moved in pieces into Kuwait. So each individual unit had to be placed on a request for forces. And it wasn't just, it wasn't just the tank unit, for example. It's the next echelon maintenance unit that's required to support the tank unit, the next echelon supply truck unit. And so we had to go to the big database, break all that down, then send a request for forces through our chain of command, so everyone knows, to the secretary. Then the secretary has to approve it. Then it comes back down and we get people rolling.
Oh, man.
The ripple effect of that was, you know, back post Vietnam, you know, the Army has the active duty Army, the Army Reserve, and the National Guard. And to there are potential decisions that are required to activate the National Guard, to activate the reserves.
Sure. Yeah.
And when you break the time phase force deployment list, you interrupt the alert mobilization and deployment cycle of guard units. So you can't have them go fits and starts because these gals all have civilian jobs too. So now we've interrupted that flow, which again adds to a level of complexity, if you will, and the amount of planning that you need to put in. Now, and we differentiate that, I call it the art and science of war. And the science of war is all of the details, as paraphrase Clausewitz from On War, a soldier with the right, the correct equipment in the correct place at the correct time. And all of that is part of the science of warfare that my officers and soldiers and I were deeply involved in.
Wow, that sounds really stressful. I just have to say.
Well, I used to cut a hair.
Oh man, so does it ring a bell if I say contingencies for the contingencies for the contingencies?
Oh, that I lived that.
Oh man, so that brings me to another question. Can you tell us what snowflakes are?
Ah, snowflakes.
Yes.
Secretary Rumsfeld, and I didn't coin that term. Someone smarter than I in the Pentagon, but the secretary would send out memos and just with one line questions. What about this? What about that? And it was it was said to us that these memos came out from the secretary's office like a blizzard, and each one was then a snowflake that would wind its way down to someone to answer. And when they came to us, as I tried to relate in the book, when one receives a question from the Secretary of Defense, or even more so from the White House, that becomes the main effort. That's the best and the brightest have to answer those questions because it's that important. You can't confuse the secretary or the president.
Right.
So, again, an interruption of the continual work because I'm pulling guys and gals off of, okay, stop doing this. Here's the latest snowflake we've got from OSD, Office of the Secretary of Defense. You've got an hour to answer this because I've got to get it to the commanding general in 90 minutes. And I need 30 minutes to read it myself. So.
Wow. Was that unusual?
So that was a snowflake.
That, I mean, that is a perfect name for what that sounds like it would have felt like. Was that unusual or was that kind of like, we're in a post 9/11 world and everything's crazy and everything's super important and everyone's freaking out? Before 9/11, was it like this constant barrage of questions and demands like that?
Well, in my experience, but again, these were peacetime. So not really. I mean, clearly, like when I was at Third Army the first time, if the CENTCOM commander, a four-star general or admiral, wanted something answered, well, yeah, I mean, that stop, drop everything, you answer that question. But it was not, they didn't come out hourly. From my reading of history, there were questions, you know, when George Marshall asked a question of Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, that became, okay, we got to put our best and brightest on it. When FDR asked a question, or Henry Simpson, the Secretary of War, you know, there were, I'm sure there were similar efforts. It's just that in the world that we live in now, with almost instant communication, the messages travel much faster.
Oh yeah, so they can come in faster and furiouser. So, what were there any tactical issues that stick out to you in the planning for how to remove Saddam Hussein from power? Tactical or philosophical issues that were just like, this is really hard to push through.
Well, and I don't want to sound too technical on this, but what that raises for me, because you know, I'm in charge of developing the plan. A part of the process of developing a plan is a war game, where we've got folks who are blue, us, the friendlies, and someone else playing red, the enemy. And we war game to try to anticipate the flow of battle and how we would fight against an enemy formation and how the enemy formation would fight against us. Now, it's nowhere near going to be what actually happens, but it's enough to help us anticipate. So what happens? Well, we crossed into Iraq, and things unfold the way we expect. But so if you recall, the 57th Maintenance Company, a company that repaired Patriot missiles, you know, those that you know, captain, he took a wrong turn and his company got ambushed. Remember, Jessica Lynch was captured, and that company, you know, was really not as effective because it was, you know, equipment was shot up. And so that's something that even though you expect something like that to happen, I don't know precisely. And it sounds cold. I mean, this will sound very cold, but part of the planning is a calculation and expectation of casualties. And the casualties are killed, wounded, and the types of wounded, which allows us to try to indicate how many hospitals are we going to need? How many ambulances, ground ambulances are we going to need? How many helicopter ambulances are we going to need? The medical supplies, bandages, whole blood, surgical equipment, all of that is part of the planning effort. And so we anticipate things like that. Did I know 5/7 was going to happen? No. Did I know where the Marines were going to have their engagement? Precisely, no. Did we try to anticipate where? Yes. So you don't know when that's going to happen precisely, but you know that battle is going to take place because, like we say, the enemy to vote.
Yeah.
And so the other thing was, since there were a lot of air operations, a lot of bombing, and so what took place was, by design, we knew where all of the land lines, so the wire communications were, and we knew where the nodes were, where the junctions, where those came together. So those got bombed to force the enemy to come up onto the radio networks so that we could hear what they were doing. And that helps us understand the flow and where they are. So those are the kind of things that, you know, was I involved in tactics of the movement of one tank and another? No. I tried to anticipate how a division commander would maneuver his brigades, a brigade being a 5,000 soldiers roughly, because what we were doing at our headquarters, and again, I don't mean to be pedantic on this, but we looked at how a division would fight because our order was being written to give tasks to the two subordinate three-star general headquarters. So we needed to communicate. We felt the 5th U.S. Corps and 1st Marine Expeditionary Force needed to do what their tasks were in order to get to Baghdad and communicate that in clear enough language. Also did not
right.
hamstring two very experienced officers, the commanding general
kind
of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force.
Balance.
Right.
It's like a balance that you have to
exactly.
kind of do.
As George Patton said, don't tell someone how to do something. Tell them what you want done and let them surprise you with their ingenuity.
Oh,
you know,
that's fantastic.
Like you were saying, that's the balance. You know, I'm not going to mm-hmm. tell a three-star general that, you know, he has to wake up in the morning, put his shoes on, tie the shoelaces, you know, and blow on his coffee before he takes a sip. You know, I'm going to tell him I want 5 Corps to defeat this division, to defeat this next Iraq division, and to then enter the city of Baghdad.
Right.
You know, language like that. Or at least that's the
fantastic.
Language that my commanding general would transmit to those subordinate commanders.
Right, right. Yeah, you can't, micromanaging never works out very well.
Absolutely right. Especially when people are shooting at you.
yeah, that too. Okay, so I wanted to ask also, so you said that the U.S. Secretary of War waited until, what was it, 30 minutes before go time? H hour, which is like the hour that an operation starts.
Yes.
Is that usual or was that particular to this time?
Well, again, our term for that was the 5,000 mile screwdriver, where it was the illusion of control, the immediacy of being able to talk via this kind of forum, but a secure video telecom. I maintain, create an illusion that someone in Washington could take a decision and expect it to be executed that instant.
Oh.
And so you forget that it's that there's time zones in between and things aren't going to happen like with a snap of fingers. So,
right.
So people in D.C. believed that could happen. I know the chairman of the Joint Chiefs knew that wasn't true.
Okay.
But there was probably an expectation on the part of the secretary that when he directed something, it was going to happen. And it was going to happen. It just wasn't going to happen that instant. Things would start. So was there interference like that? Actually, no. Once the operation started, did we still continue to get snowflakes? Yes. Was he trying to, from Washington, trying to micromanage the movement of 5 Corps and 1st Marine Expeditionary Force? No, not really. But
okay.
He was asking questions. Now, again, for example, a famous one. Pardon me. General Scott Wallace, the commanding general of 5th Corps. Remember, we had embedded reporters with us.
Yep.
Well, there was a reporter embedded with, who was traveling with General Wallace. And the sandstorm that we knew was going to happen, we just didn't know precisely when, arises about the same time that all the irregular forces started to come up out of the ground and fighting along our line of advance. And General Wallace says, perfectly reasonably, that the plan we war gamed is not what's happening. It's not what we're executing. Absolutely true. But it's interpreted in D.C. Remember the press conferences? So now the press is saying, well, Mr. Secretary, the plan is not working. This is what Wallace just said. So there's that kind of factor that raises its head. And now someone's got to explain to the secretary, let's put the context in, you know, And even the embedded reporters didn't realize the consternation that was going to cause in Washington, because they were there with Wallace. They'd been briefed up. They knew what they were trying to do. And I said, did we anticipate that all of the irregular forces were going to magically appear? No. I figured that there would be some form of resistance like that, but not the way they manifested themselves. So that's why planning gets us to a certain level, and then after that, it's adjustments, it's adaptation. But that was
be really quick on your feet.
Moment. Yeah, that was a moment. That's what was transmitted, and you know, I don't blame press. I mean, they're in business to sell newspapers and airtime, right?
Sure.
So when you're going to ask a question, when the Secretary of Defense is saying everything's wonderful, and now one of the generals on the ground says, hey, you know, the fight's not going the way we anticipated. Boing.
Yeah, so, you're going to latch onto that for sure.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
I were a journalist, I'd be like, excuse me, I'm going to ask you about this. Okay, before we go, can you just give us a brief description? I don't want to, you know, I think people should read the book. And so I kind of want to just...
I appreciate
put a,
it.
Yeah, I think I want to put a little bit in there about what was briefly the exit plan for Iraq, for exiting. What were we supposed to do?
The plan that my officers and I wrote called Eclipse 2. Eclipse 1 was the post-war plan for Germany. Eclipse 2, at the time we wrote it, envisioned that what we would do is our headquarters would conduct, broadly stated, emergency repair of critical infrastructure and restore a level of security so that non-governmental organizations and UN organizations could operate in relative safety, and then hand over the mission of completing the restoration of order and the establishment of a new government to a headquarters that would follow up. And that's the way the Central Command campaign was written. And that's so I took that for our major operations plan, is that would be our end state. And that's what we were working on. When we continued our war gaming, it was the most complex war game I had ever done. Because there were so many, if you will, shades of red, you know, Sunni, Shia, other you know, terrorist organizations of various names would want to have a shot at us. There might have been shadow threats coming out of Syria. We didn't know what the Iranians were going to do. And there were shades of blue, the coalition of the willing. And we had different rules of engagement than the Poles, then the Spanish, then the Italians. And so how did each nation establish its rules of engagement for its forces who were going to participate? So all of that contributed. That's why we wrote another entire plan called Eclipse 2, which again was focused on the material completion of establishing a secure situation and doing the emergency repair of critical infrastructure.
Mind-boggling. This is
mind-boggling. It was a challenge.
Oh, you really had to know what you were doing. Oh my God, that's like almost overwhelming to think about. Wow.
It was a challenge.
Probably an understatement. I have one more question for you. I love this phrase. Can you tell us what is catastrophic success?
Catastrophic success. In General Franks asked us, you know, what if there's catastrophic success? And that meaning that the expectation that we cross into Iraq and the Iraqi army, everyone just surrenders right away. And there's infighting among factions in Baghdad, and we have to get to Baghdad as fast as possible. And, you know, someone might have deposed Saddam and put himself in power and said, hey, I'll negotiate with you guys. What do you want? Catastrophic success. And for the land forces, it became, how can we get to Baghdad as fast as possible with enough force to, you know, again, to show that we mean business, regardless of conditions. That was catastrophic.
So you had to plan for success, and not just success, but catastrophic success. Wow.
Which
That's
was
a whole
another,
other ball game.
It was another whole effort.
Wow.
And there again, you come into how much risk are we willing to take? And people throw risk around a lot. In this sense, it was risk to the soldiers that we would send, because as I answered a question to the Secretary of Defense, an M1 to move one M1 tank to Baghdad, you know, it takes, you know, an entire truck company's worth of fuelers to keep the tank fueled. Soldiers have to eat, they have to drink water, they're going to shoot bullets.
Yeah.
And so you can take some logistical risk by the tank sitting there just before they're running out of gas, so that the next folks hot on their heels can fuel and rearm them. And all of that, you know, plays a factor. So, yeah, they were exciting times.
Man, so how much history do you have to know about a country, or in this instance, even? Like, you have to study what the political differences between all the, as you said, shades of red, and what might happen because of this. How much history do you have to learn about a country while you're doing this?
Well, when I went overseas, I took a book by Raphael Patai, The Arab Mind. I took a book, and these were all probably dated. And I know that there are anthropologists out there who will cringe, Patai. but we could to learn about, you know, Iraqis as opposed to Saudis, Sunni as opposed to Shia. I mean, I didn't read the entire Quran, but I read parts of the Quran.
Oh.
We had experts come in who were in the army. They're called foreign area officers. And so there were officers who'd learned how to speak Arabic. Might not have, because we didn't have anybody stationed in Iraq, but you know, we had officers who were in the region who had dealt with Arabs Arab armies before. Before I went to Third Army, I was at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the security studies program. And I reached back to my professors, not asking them classified things, but, you know, asking them, what do you know about, what, recommend a book for me, and things like that. And I mentioned Evan Helfer, PhD in history. He reached back to his network of friends at West Point in the history department. And all of us who'd been, you know, our army spends money and time educating its officers. So we do on all of our professional knowledge. We really do.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know what's interesting is, if you ever heard the phrase of the concept of a Google, which is like this crazy amount of it's a crazy huge number, and there's this idea that the human brain can't possibly even comprehend or imagine what a Google is. And I feel like that reminds me a little of what you're talking about, trying to plan all this stuff and everything that goes into it. Like, it reminds me of trying to think of a Google. Like, you can't even think of everything. That's crazy. The amount.
And the thing too, you have to realize that you can't think of everything. You know, anyone who thinks that way is wrong. We have to understand limits. And again, we realize that the plan gets us to the start of the operation. And then once execution begins, you have to continuously stay engaged. You continuously think, because conditions are going to change. The end vote.
Yeah.
And so how does that affect our plan? And believe me, I carried that when I went back, because after I left Iraq, I was the director of the School of Advanced Military Studies. I tried to carry that back to prepare those officers who I knew were going to go back to war. Here's the reality. This is what we've got to think about.
Knowing your limits and understanding that you can't even try to know what everything is. That's a good lesson, I think.
Right.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions. And yeah, can I ask, is there anything else you're planning on doing? Any other books you're planning on writing?
Well, I contributed two chapters to two different books.
Oh.
One that just came out called Professionals Talk Logistics.
Nice.
And another one is a book that I think is going to come out in the fall. It's an anthology of history about the Cold War in Europe.
Really?
Yeah. The title of that book tentatively is Lariat Advance. Lariat Advance is the code word for the Soviets are coming across the border.
Oh.
So that was the Cold War Army that were,
oh,
and
wow.
I was privileged to be a part of that. Now, am I going to write another book? Yeah. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, it took me four years to find an editor, a publisher. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
That's surprising. That's really surprising.
Well,
I mean, it's a good book. So that is very shocking to hear that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, okay. Thank you again. And I hope you have a good rest of your week.
Thank you so much. You too. And again, thank you for the privilege of being part of your effort. I really appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.